the wonderful surprise speaker that we have at lunch, and you recognize him immediately, I'm sure. I just want to do it's very difficult to produce a short biography of a fellow who's been working for 40 years as an ocean environmental champion, but let me just give you a couple of the highlights. Ed Markey is a national leader on climate, clean energy, and the environment. He is a member of the Environment and Public Works Committee, the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee, and the Foreign Relations Committee. He is also the chair of the Senate Climate Task Force. These key positions, combined with his more than 40 years of legislative experience, make him a powerful influence on national and international climate and energy policy. He has amassed an unparalleled record of legislative achievements, most recently by co-authoring the Green New Deal resolution with Congressman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. He is the principal author, house author, of a 2000 fuel economy law, which sets the miles per gallon standard. As you know, that's a critical piece. He is also the author of an Appliance Efficiency Act in 1987. In 2009, Ed partnered with Congressman Henry Waxman to write the landmark Waxman-Markey bill, which, by the way, is the only comprehensive climate legislation ever to pass a chamber of Congress, either chamber. Recently, Senator Markey introduced legislation that would spur the growth of offshore wind energy by extending tax credits for this burgeoning renewable industry. In the Senate, he has introduced legislation to create a national climate bank, outlined a vision for a green and climate-friendly infrastructure legislative package, and is the champion for legislation that will help improve America's public health resources response to climate change and support climate education in schools. That's just a few of the highlights. Let me add my own 2 cents. I've had the distinct privilege of working with Congressman Markey, now Senator Markey. He was a congressman. He was a representative in the Massachusetts House when we first started working together, then in the U.S. House of Representatives, and now in the Senate on ocean and coastal issues. And he is an ocean champion as well as an environmental and climate change champion. It has always been terrific. And from that experience, I can tell you there is simply no one, that's in capital letters, no one in Congress that has a better track record, more encyclopedic knowledge of or passion for creating a sustainable planet. This is the one person in the Congress that we need there more than ever. Let me say it a different way. He is irreplaceable. He is irreplaceable. Please remember that in November. I'm thrilled to introduce to you Senator Markey.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you, Rich. Thank all of you. Thank you so much. Thank you all for your great leadership on this issue. If Cape Cod is the bared and bended arm of Massachusetts, then all of you here participating are the strength of Cape Cod and the islands in putting together a plan to deal with this catastrophic threat that is being created because of human activity. So we're here in order to make sure that Massachusetts, which is only 2% of America's population, but we're not an ordinary 2%. We're not just the Bay State. We're the brain state. So what you're doing and gathering is intended to put together an action plan that can be a model to be used in order to deal with this threat. And let's be honest. The climate crisis is the national security, economic, health, environmental, and moral challenge of our time. And we do not have an option. We have to be the leaders who are going to be putting together the solutions that will be put in place. So the United Nations has said quite clearly that climate change is an existential threat to the planet. Our own 13 federal agencies last November completed a report which said that if we do not act, we could have upwards of a 9-degree Fahrenheit warming of the planet. And there's a big difference between 79 degrees, let's go out for a nice walk, and 88 degrees, let's stay inside and turn on the air conditioning. 9-degree Fahrenheit warming by the year 2100, 81 years from now. That is an existential threat. The United Nations, our own 13 federal agencies, are saying the exact same thing, that we have to deal with this threat to the planet. And where do we see it manifesting itself? Well, except for the Arctic, we have the second fastest warming body of water on the planet off of our coastline. And we see it manifesting itself in so many different ways that you are discussing here at this conference. And it is something that is only going to intensify. Tornadoes in July on the Cape are not ordinary. I came down here the day after to tour the communities that were impacted back on July 25th. Just absolutely amazing to see what happened. And it is only, as we all know in this room, a preview of coming attractions. It's just going to be something that becomes a built-in part of the normal, not just for the Cape, not just for the islands, not just for Massachusetts, not just for the United States, but for the whole planet. So we have this incredible moment in time where our own scientists are saying a 9 degrees warming Fahrenheit would be accompanied by, at a worst-case scenario, a 10-foot rise in sea level, 10 feet. Now, what is that threat? Well, the threat would be Greenland. Greenland is right above us, and it's 1,000 miles long, 300 miles wide, but it's got a block of ice on it that's about 10 Empire State Buildings high. That goes into the water because of the warming. That's like putting a massive ice cube into a glass of water that's already filled. And who would be impacted? Well, obviously the Cape and the islands, the east coast of the United States in a dramatic way. And as we all know, water, when it's warmer, expands. So the warmer this water gets is the more that it expands. And all of this is scientifically indisputable as it all comes together as a threat. So that's why I worked successfully to passed the law in 2007 to increase the fuel economy standards of the vehicles which we drive that President Obama used, along with the California Clean Air Act waiver to increase fuel economy standards to 54.5 miles per gallon. Trump is now rolling all that back. He's saying that's too high of a goal. Now, who's he doing that for? Well, obviously the oil companies. Their business model is at risk if we improve the transportation system. Their business model is at risk if Dan Wolf can have the first airline that has all electric engines. Huh? It's at risk. We put 70% of the oil which we consume into gasoline tanks. So if you're changing that model in terms of the efficiency of our society, if you're putting together a plan to make it more likely that it'll be convenient for people to just plug in their vehicle, and you have a comprehensive plan to be able to accomplish that goal or to plug in the plane overnight, well, that's an existential threat to the business model of the fossil fuel industry. So they would prefer to keep the existential threat to the planet in place rather than the existential threat to their business model. And that's why we're in this incredible fight. And what we need is the leadership of the Cape and the islands to just show that people can come together in a collaborative way in order to show that there is a powerful political force on the other side. So we thank you, Rich, for all of your historic leadership on this issue, coming back from the Paris Agreement and saying we need to organize, not agonize, about this issue. And we can do it. So, as Rich said, I was able to, with Henry Waxman, to pass the comprehensive Waxman-Markey bill through the House in 2009. That's an 80% reduction in greenhouse gases by the year 2050. But Mitch McConnell and the oil and coal companies killed it in the Senate. John Kerry tried as best he could, but just came up a couple of votes short because Obama said he was ready to sign it. That was 1,400 pages. I know how to do a 1,400-page bill. But in February of this year, I decided what we needed was not just a resolution, we needed a revolution. So, partnering with Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I introduced the Green New Deal into the Senate, along with her in the House. From that moment on, there's been a transformation in the debate in our country. Just going back to 2016, not one reporter asked Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump a question about climate change in 2016. Not 2016, not one question. Well, the Green New Deal has now solved that problem. Everyone now has to be able to talk in a comprehensive way about this issue, because that is the change that has taken place. And whether it's the climate strikers, just a couple of weeks, not just on campuses, but in cities and towns all across the United States and all across the world, it's unleashed this incredible energy, this generational energy, where young people are saying, we don't have confidence in the preceding generations because you have not dealt with this issue. So this is our challenge. It's to put together a comprehensive intergenerational compact to deal with this subject and to deal with it now. So we thank you for being here. Now, what can we do? Well, we can say, well, how the federal government should be partnering with local communities. It should be trying to figure out how can we, in the transportation sector, for example, not just go to 54 miles per gallon, but 64 miles per gallon. 74 miles per gallon. By then, it's an all-electric fleet. By then, it's just impractical not to go in that direction. And you wind up, otherwise, with a continuation of the temperature increasing. So that's number one. And in order to accomplish that goal, we need to put permanent tax breaks on the books for all electric vehicles so that the consumer knows that's going to be there as a tax break. We need permanent tax breaks for storage and energy technologies so that the breakthroughs occur in the scientific research so that we reach a point where not only do we have storage technologies, but that, like the breakthroughs we made with these phones, you have a power that was never imagined. Like, this is now equal to the computing power on the Apollo mission that Senator Wolf was just referring to. We can do it. But you have to put in place the regulatory and tax policies in order to accomplish that goal and create millions of jobs here simultaneously, blue-collar jobs, to manufacture and deploy all of these technologies. We can do it. And if those incentives were in place, the CAPE would be right at the front of the line with regard to how do we then implement a all-electric vehicle, a plug-in strategy, a storage strategy to be able to telescope the time frame that it takes in order to accomplish that goal. With Senator Chris Van Hollen, Rich mentioned it, I introduced in July a climate bank of $35 billion, which would leverage upwards of $700 billion worth of resources to have low-interest loans be available when a local community or a state had put together an entity to deal with it that could then be loaned out to municipalities, to states, to the private sector, so that they can have that low-interest loan available to them in order to install these new technologies, to move in that direction. And then at the end of the day, when those loans are repaid, the net cost to the federal government would be very, very low. But the benefit in the installation of these new technologies would be vast. It could be used to insulate buildings. It could be used to deploy new technologies. It could be used in order to solve the problem. We could do the same thing with agriculture, encouraging no-till technology so that we don't see the unnecessary release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We could do the same thing with increasing the permanent tax breaks for wind and solar. When we introduced the Green New Deal, Trump called it socialism. He called it socialism. And then on Fox News, almost every day this year, socialism, socialism, socialism. So a lot of blue-collar workers, they start to hear this socialism. Now, the Green New Deal doesn't get as much coverage, interestingly, on MSNBC or CNN as Fox pays to it because it's an existential threat to the Koch brother and ExxonMobil agenda. So it's all day just attacking it. So I say to them, okay, what do you call tax breaks for the oil industry, for the coal industry, for the natural gas industry for 100 years? Because you're saying that if we do that for renewables, it's socialism. So I say to them, if tax breaks for wind and solar and coal for 100 years is something you accept, and you then describe those tax breaks as socialism, well, give us some of that socialism for wind and solar and battery storage technologies and all electric vehicles and all electric buildings, and we will bury the fossil fuel industry within 10 to 20 years. It will be all over because we'll have the level playing field. We'll have an ability then to be able to compete in the marketplace in a very effective way. So let me just give you some optimistic numbers, because beginning about 10 years ago, we were able to put some of these tax breaks on the books. We were able to create some of the incentives. So I want you to, in your mind, just to pick some numbers. So just going back to 2008, how many total solar megawatts had been deployed in the United States? Just pick a number in your brain. It's only 2,000 megawatts of solar as of 2008. But tax breaks went on the books at the federal level. There were state mandates to increase the amount of solar that would be deployed. We've gone from 2,000 to 65,000 megawatts of solar by the end of 2018 because finally the policies began to be put in place. Now, going back to 2008 on wind, there were 25,000 megawatts of wind. Today, well, the end of 2018, it was up to 100,000 megawatts, four times more in a brief period of time. Did it get sunnier from 2008? Did it get windier since 2008? No, we began to change the policies. We began to create incentives to be able to accomplish that goal. Now, all electric vehicles. How many total all electric vehicles were there in the United States in 2008? Total. The answer, 2,000. 2,000. You might have seen the movie about how General Motors killed the all-electric vehicle. They did a good job. So 2000 and 2008, where are we today? Well, today we're going to have 1 million by the end of this year deployed. So in the same way there's a Moore's Law for these technologies in terms of becoming more and more and more and more efficient, so too is there a Moore's Law with different names for wind and solar and battery storage technologies and all-electric vehicles. And a lot of it, obviously, needs the correct policies, which are going to be put on the books to be able to accomplish these goals. And you're going to need evidence that it can work, evidence that people are willing to partner, that there are financial institutions, there are civic organizations, there are nonprofits who are willing to come together to put together the environment within which these technologies can work and will be deployed. So July and August were the warmest 2 months ever recorded in the history of temperatures being taken. And by the way, it's not complicated when he says we can't trust the science. The way we do it is with a very complicated technology called thermometers. And we've been keeping these records for a long, long time here on the Cape and all across the country. So we know it's accurate. We know it's a lot warmer than it was. And it's not just anecdotal, our own sense of how much warmer it is. We know from science that it is, in fact, true. So we can do this. We can mandate standards for buildings to be twice as efficient as they're newly constructed today, or three times more efficient, or four times more efficient, to just back out the energy that would otherwise have to be produced to be able to provide that energy for air conditioning or heating in this room. When Rich mentioned my appliance efficiency law, well, that's a 1987 law that led to promulgation of new regulations for how efficient air conditioning has to be. You know, and the industry first didn't want it, but think about it like this. In Texas, in the summer, 80% of peak demand for all electricity is air conditioning. Now, you make that air conditioning standard twice as efficient, you've backed out the need for dozens of coal-burning plants to ever have been constructed in the first place. That was my intent. My mother used to say to me, Eddie, you have to learn how to work smarter and not harder. That's energy efficiency. She says, unless you do that, Eddie, we're going to donate your brain to Harvard Medical School as a completely unused human organ, right? So what we're trying to do here is to ensure that we create the smarter, not harder way of dealing with these issues. The harder way is dealing with a New York Times report that Barnstable would be the seventh most expensive place in the United States to deal with climate change if a storm hit. Upwards of $1 billion worth of harm. Here's the number, it ran on the front page of the New York Times. The analysis said that the cost of Barnstable would be $889 million to protect its residents from storm surge and sea level rise using seawalls by 2040. This puts Barnstable amongst the most expensive American cities to protect, number seven overall and number two per capita in the United States. That's where we're having our conference, huh? That's what we're talking about. So you are the canary in the mine shaft, and this conference is just inspirational. You know, you're the leaders. You're it. And the smarter you are, the more comprehensive the plan that you put together is, the more likely we'll be able to then have your model spread across the rest of the country. And we are the state of revolutionaries, from the American Revolution to the abolitionist movement to the suffragette movement to the same-sex marriage revolution to the Affordable Care Act revolution. We are the revolutionaries. And that's what you're doing here today. And we've already seen the results over the last 10 years of the beginning of policies, but we have to do twice as good, three times as good, five times as good, 10 times as good, and it's all there. It's not a question of technology, it's a question of political will. If we have the political will, this will happen. So if you can come together and just show that the politics of this know no barriers, that there's a practical threat that you all see, whether you are ultra-liberal, tree-hugging environmentalists are very pragmatic, green eyeshade bankers, that you all realize that this problem is one that is unavoidable, and you have to come together to just find the solutions. So all I can tell you is that I'm proud to be here, and I'm very proud of each and every one of you for everything that you're doing, and just know that you can be the model for this issue all across the rest of the country. You are living with a threat, but you also have the potential to begin to put together the solutions that will be the model for national legislation, state legislation, and municipal legislation all across this country. Thank you all so much for everything that you do. Thank you for your great leadership on this issue.
Thank you.